Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to Food Without Borders on Heritage Radio Network, a show about food, culture, identity, and politics. I am your host, Sari Kamen. Happy Valentine's Day to all of my listeners out there. For our special Valentine's Day episode, which is not a special Valentine's Day episode at all, I have Priya Krishna on the show. She is a food writer whose prolific work covers the culinary world, and she brings Indian food culture to the forefront. Her writing has appeared in The New Yorker, The New York Times, and Bon Appetit, among many others. And her next cookbook, Indian-ish, is about her mother, whom she calls an Indian food genius. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's Priya, actually.
Oh, I'm so sorry. And no I just problem. Asked you that. Yes. It's been a long day. Thank you, Priya. Thank you for coming on the show today and spending some of your Valentine's Day as my date.
Of course. I'm happy to.
So tell us a little bit about... You're from Texas, yes?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So, and your parents are immigrants from India?
Yes.
Okay. So tell me a little bit about what it was like to grow up in Texas.
You know, it's funny because when people never think that I'm from Texas. That's the last place that they guess. And then when they do, they're like, what was that like growing up mm-hmm. in this really southern place? But to be very honest, I lived sort of within this suburban bubble. Like my county was really liberal. My school was really liberal. My family hung out mostly with other Indians. It didn't feel like the Texas that a lot of people know it to be, really like conservative, lots of cowboys, very southern. I didn't have Texas barbecue until I was 23 years old and on a business trip in Austin. So it was definitely a very unconventional Texas upbringing. But then being in New York, I notice certain Texan things in myself. Like I hate when restaurants charge for chips and salsa in Texas. That's just not a thing.
It shouldn't be a thing here either. That's something I would agree with Texas on. I can't think of many things, but that's
yeah. That complimentary right. chips and salsa, people. Just do it.
Universal healthcare, universal chips and salsa. So first of all, I want to congratulate you on your IACP nomination, which just happened.
Thank you.
That is just an amazing accomplishment. And you wrote this wonderful piece for Bon Appetit about the Patel Brothers grocery store. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. That was an interesting story because, like many of my stories, it was my dad's idea. He always comes to me, will call me breathlessly with these story ideas. And more often than not, those turn out to be some of my best stories. And my dad has been going to Patel Brothers since it opened in Dallas. It's this like amazing grocery store that's basically, you know, done to Indian grocery shopping what, you know, a place like Wegmans did to American grocery shopping. Yeah. You know, it made it really standardized, affordable, easy to find, really intuitive, really accessible. And I think more importantly than making it, you know, a really great place for Indians to shop, it's a really great place for non-Indians to shop and still be able to find whatever they need. Everything's like very organized. Everything's explained in English and Hindi. And so when we're talking about places that sort of help to advance Indian culture and perhaps make it more mainstream and understood, I think Patel Brothers is a huge part of that conversation. And, you know, they're a national grocery store chain. They've got locations all across the U.S. Their products, they own a product brand called Swath Foods, which are literally even sold in India. So like this Indian grocery store in America is like selling products to India because they're so good. And I was just so blown away by the stories that people were telling me about how the products they get at Patel Brothers are better than what they find in India. And just the way that place has resonated with Indians and non-Indians alike was really special. So I was excited that the IACP recognized it. I didn't even know it was submitted.
Yeah, that's cool. Is there something like a little bit heartbreaking about, you know, hearing stories about how products at Patel Brothers are better than like the actual Indian version? Like there's something about, you know, globalization sometimes where you're like, oh, it kind of sucks that like I don't have to go to India or France or wherever anymore to like find this very unique and special thing.
Well, of course, I definitely feel that way. But on the other hand, what the founder told me is that in India, a lot of the products, like their health standards, their sort of mostly the health standards just like aren't that high. Whereas in America, the health standards are a lot stricter. The codes are a lot more stringent. So you end up getting things that are probably a little bit safer to consume. So I feel like that's something I can get behind. But there definitely is that feeling of nostalgia. There's still certain things that you can only find in India that you'll never be able to get that same quality in America. So I think that will always be there.
I hope that's the case. You know, I mean, how does a place like that, like Patel Brothers, sort of change, you know, the non-Indian consumer's understanding of what Indian food is?
I think it just makes it seem really accessible. Like when everything is organized the same way an American grocery store is organized, when everything is clearly labeled, when things are in a language that you understand, it's just like a real game changer. And the Indian grocery stores you used to go before, even as someone who understands mostly Hindi, like I would get confused, you know, stuff would be thrown on the floor. The employees weren't actually there to help you. Produce would be like a total mess. They're just like these really disorganized, chaotic stores. And there just like wasn't a real understanding of customer service. So I think at the base level, Patel Brothers just like provides like the base needs of a grocery store.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Last week on the show, I had another food writer, Mayuk Sen, and he was talking about like how most Americans perceive Indian food as a monolith. And I would hope that a place like Patel Brothers is able to sort of add nuance to the conversation of what Indian food can be.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I just came off of, I had about 120 people test recipes for my cookbook. And of course, a lot of them had to go shopping for spices and ingredients. And a lot of the feedback I got was like, you know, places like Patel Brothers and Kloustian's make it so easy to shop for Indian ingredients. I thought this was going to be so much harder. I thought Indian food was one thing, and this has really changed my perspective. So that's exciting to hear.
Yeah. Have you always been into food?
Yes. There is never a waking moment in my life where I can't remember food sort of at least being occupying like 10 to 20% of my mind.
Yeah. I mean, you're doing a cookbook now and it's all about your mother's recipes. And I want to get to that a little bit later. But I was reading this piece, this lovely piece that you wrote in Sever about how your mother would make mashup foods, and it remind you know, foods that she grew up with in India, and it was sort of like, it's sort of a combination of the foods from her childhood mashed up with American ingredients, like I think you mentioned pizza with roti bread or sandwiches with curry leaves. And it reminded me of an article that Solejo wrote for Taste, mm-hmm, called Assimilation Food. I was wondering, yeah, if you'd read that.
I had. It's a great story.
Yeah, it is a great story. And I was wondering if you could kind of speak to that and how that sort of affected your framework and your reference for what Indian food was like growing up as American in Texas with immigrant parents.
It just feels to me like just only natural and what every immigrant does. I don't know a single child of immigrants whose parents sort of don't have a roughly similar story of like they came to this country, they knew how to cook a certain way, but they, you know, were facing a totally different country with different cuisine, different ingredients, different grocery stores. And so they just had to adapt. And that's where this really amazing innovation comes out. That's how like modern American food is constructed. And so to me, when I think of my mom making pizza with roti bread or crusting our sandwiches with fried curry leaves or making saag paneer with feta instead of paneer because she couldn't find it, I think that is sort of the kind of food that we are moving towards. Mm-hmm. I think that if you look in like two generations from now, all food will be sort of mixed up and mashed up. I mean, even if you look at, you know, cuisines that we see as like very essential, like Italian food or Mexican food. It's all sort of like mashups of different cultures. That's just sort of how, you know, waves of immigration happen and affect food. So one thing that I thought was really important was in the subhead, calling our food American, because, you know, just because we're not making burgers and steak and fried chicken at home doesn't mean we're not American. I hate when people conflate the word American with white people. That drives me crazy. I mean, to me, like, this is what American food is. Like, I grew up in America, and the food that I ate in America were these really awesome mashup dishes. And so I don't know. I think it's really exciting. I love hearing other friends tell me about the dishes that their parents made. And I just don't think this is a unique phenomenon, but it is an exciting one.
Yeah, I don't think it's unique at all. But did it take you a while to sort of come to that conclusion that these were really awesome foods that your mom was making you? Because I think you mentioned in that same piece that there was a bit of resentment at some point that, you know, you would go to friends' houses and the food was really different. And, you know, you had to like sit at the table and have a meal and you couldn't like eat in your room like your other friends could. And there's a little bit of, I don't know if resentment is the word, but there was an understanding that there was something different.
Of course, whenever you're a minority in any way, you sort of crave whatever the majority has. And for me, you know, the majority was my friends who are primarily white and Jewish and, you know, ate certain things for dinner that we did not. And so I remember it being Passover and me being like, Mom, like, why aren't we eating matzah like everyone else?
Oh,
and
she was funny. Just
like, we're not Jewish. We don't celebrate Passover. But like the norm to me was like Passover. And I was just like, we need to be having like, you know, matzah with lox like everyone else. Like, why are we having dal chowl?
That's hysterical. you didn't understand like there was a disconnect that you weren't Jewish or that you didn't understand that they were Jewish. It just was the normal thing.
Yeah, I just craved normalcy, and I was one of just a couple Indian kids in my grade, and so just like everything that we did felt so alien and different, and I hated having to explain it to people, and I preferred to just try and fit in as much as possible so I didn't have to explain. But now I'm sort of swung all the way to the other side. I've just like leaned into these differences. That's sort of what I base my writing
career
on.
You have a career around it. Yeah. Yeah. I grew up the daughter of a rabbi. And there were a lot of other Jews around, but because I didn't have a choice in the matter, like I had to go to temple and I had to go to, you know, participate in holidays. I was always so resentful of it. And I didn't make like that many specific connections to food at the time. I just knew that like whatever it was I had to do was what I didn't want to do. So on the other side of the coin. So how did you come to this place in your writing career where you not primarily necessarily, but a lot of your pieces are about sort of uncovering immigrant stories, like specifically these like hidden pockets throughout America where there's these really vibrant Indian communities and shining a light on them.
Yeah. I mean, well, one, you write what you know. Mm-hmm. But I obviously don't want to put myself in a box where I'm only writing about Indian food, because that's not the only thing that interests me. But, you know, after the election, I had the sort of moment where I started thinking about like whose stories I wanted to be telling and whose stories like deserved most to be telling. And for me, that was, you know, women, people of color, immigrants, members of the queer community. And so I just decided that I was going to focus like 95% of my writing efforts on these. Like when I do a profile, it's pretty much never going to be about a white dude. When I pitch a story to a big publication like the New York Times, it's, you know, probably going to be about a minority or an immigrant or person or a woman or any combination of those things, just because I think those voices are just perennially underrepresented in media. And I just want to be that small person who's just slowly pushing the boulder up the wall and getting them the representation they deserve.
Yeah. And it's so nice that there are writers like you and Mayuk, for example, because now that there are more and more stories coming forward that are representing written about communities, I think that audiences are realizing how deprived that they've been and are just hungry for more stories like that. So it's great that more people want to talk about it, because I think more people want to listen at the same time.
Yeah, totally. I'm reading Gabrielle Union's memoir. She's this like amazing actress. And I just read this chapter about how like only now we're realizing that Friends was totally white and there were only two black people ever on the show.
Oh, that's so funny.
Which is just astonishing.
Yeah. And like there was really no one there was no one calling. I mean, I'm sure there was people trying to call it out at the time, but nobody was listening.
Yeah.
There was no one to amplify those voices. So I'd love to hear a little bit about your mom, who you said was never a trained cook in India, which was unusual, and was an engineer and kind of broke many molds, and then was a prolific cook who inspired you to now write a cookbook.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like you've got most of the story down there.
I
mean,
well, I want to hear it in your words.
She grew up in a town outside Delhi. She had two brothers. She always tells me stories about how when people would come from out of town, they would give her brothers gifts and they wouldn't give her anything. And it was sort of this very sexist society. But my grandmother, my mom's mom, was sort of this ahead of her time feminist who, you know, really didn't want to spend her whole day in the kitchen. So she didn't really have an interest in cooking. She wanted to be a lawyer. She never could because, you know, the society just wasn't advanced at the time. But my mom really was inspired by that. And, you know, but what she did really like was cooking. And so she would go over to her grandmother's place and just watch her cook. And then when she immigrated to America, she had all these memories of her grandmother's cooking, but no techniques that she'd learned. And then she was in a new place. She got hired as a software engineer for an airline company, and she got to travel the world as a result. And, you know, this was all when she was in her 20s, like right before she had kids. So when she had us and she had to feed us, she sort of developed this cuisine that was all her own. It was rooted in Indian flavors, but it pulled inspiration from all around the world, from South Africa, from London, from the Middle East, all of these places that she was traveling to for work. And she also discovered that she had a really innate sense for flavors. She knew how to put things together. She just sort of knew what would go together, what flavor combinations would go together.
Is that why you call her a genius?
Yeah, she is. And she sort of just knows, like, she just has these tips and tricks that just come so naturally to her. Like, I always think, you know, in another life, if my mom didn't become an engineer, she would have been an amazing cookbook author, recipe writer, recipe developer. I'm just trying to give her that second life.
What was it like testing recipes with her? I mean, you said, you know, after growing up and having her cook for you your whole life, you finally got to cook for her.
Yeah, that was a really difficult month. I feel like whenever people ask me about it, they're like, oh, it must have been such an amazing bonding experience.
I mean, like it would be, yeah.
It was, but it was super painful. Like, I would wake up really early in the morning, go grocery shopping, cook a bunch of recipes, come home. My mom would critique all of the recipes, and then we would make three more dishes together, and I would edit those recipes. And then we would do another tasting, and then she would sit down and write more recipes while I help my dad do the dishes. And, you know, there were so many times when my mom would sort of fidget with a recipe and wouldn't tell me, so I couldn't note it down, and I would yell at her. There were times where we'd sort of be just, like, yelling at each other, and we'd have to go into our corners and cool off. But, I mean, the good thing is, like, it's my mom, so it's like when your writing partner is your mom, you know that, like, even if you're yelling at each other, it's all going to be okay in, like, 5 minutes.
Were there things you learned about your mom during that time period that you didn't really know before?
I mean, whenever I would complain about having to spend all day cooking or having to put out like a meal on the table, she would remind me that she would get home from work when we were growing up, she would get home from work at 6 and we'd demand that dinner be on the table by 6:30. And so she had to put out what I did in 5 hours and 30 minutes. And I sort of gained a newfound appreciation and just like additional shame for how much I complained when I was growing up.
That must have been really satisfying for her.
Yeah, I definitely think it was.
So when does your book come out?
It comes out in spring of 2019.
And they're all recipes created by your mom?
A few of them are from family members. We are super close with our family on both my mom's and my dad's side. So I wanted to get just a couple, like 5 or 6 recipes that really meant a lot to me and meant a lot to my mom, but 90% are from my mother.
That is, I mean, I know you said that it was difficult, but like what a lovely thing that you get to do and own and give to your mother and have.
Yeah. I mean, as I've been writing this book, weirdly, people have been mailing me like their family cookbooks. They're not officially published, but they're just like internal cookbooks. That's and I think that's so important to sort of keep a log of your family recipes, because otherwise those just, you know, get lost through generations. And these are really amazing heirloom dishes.
Yeah. I think you're doing what a lot of people wish they could do.
Yeah.
We're going to take a quick break and listen to a commercial, and then we'll be back with Priya Krishna.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's unique store in Lower Manhattan is home to perhaps the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan, plus the rarest natural sharpening stones and exquisitely designed tableware. They also host special events such as knife sharpening demonstrations and parties with New York's most famous chefs and restaurateurs. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the implicit and elegance of Japanese culture to your table, be it in your home or in the finest restaurant. For more information, visit korin.com.
You're listening to Food Without Borders on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Sari Kamen. I'm in studio with Priya Krishna. She's a food writer and the author of the forthcoming cookbook, Indian-ish. We've been talking about her mom, who is the inspiration for her cookbook. And you told us a little bit about your mom and a little bit about your dad, who both emigrated to the United States from India, and you grew up in Texas as a first-generation American Indian. And you also talked a little bit about how your writing has been kind of inspired by the election and how you seek more to highlight stories of women and people of color and immigrant communities. And, you know, it's just, I know you said you didn't have a very typical experience being in Texas, but like, are there any... Like, what are your thoughts about being from Texas and being, you know, having been raised by two immigrants and being a woman? Like, I mean, how does that feel at this point in the United States, and how does it feel for your parents?
I mean, it's sort of ever since the election, it's sort of this deep, constant anxiety that I feel, and it's like, you just feel like unsettled always, and you can't put your finger on why. And then you realize that it's just literally because of who is in the White House. And mm-hmm. I realized that, you know, during the Obama years, I really took government for granted and just assumed that they were on my side and, you know, didn't think about the fact that I was from Texas and that I could make political change. But I have just like totally reframed my thinking. So I'm still, I spend like half the year in Texas, half the year here. So I'm technically still a Texas resident. So I've sort of tried to use my Texas status as much as possible. Like I am the person like bothering Ted Cruz and John Cornyn like every single day, to the point where their staffers like know the sound of my voice. My aunt recently launched this initiative. She's a pediatrician living in Texas called SAVE, which is called South Asian Voter Empowerment. Basically, hoping to get out the vote to South Asians, who make up an enormous part of the Texas population, but a lot of them don't turn out to vote. Like, you know, they always say if immigrants in Texas voted, it would be definitively a blue state. So
I can't even picture that.
Yeah. And so I feel like the election was just sort of this huge wake-up call that there was just a lot that I could be doing that I wasn't doing. And for me, that started with my writing, but it's also just sort of these like daily forms of resistance, whether it's sort of calling out intolerance when you see it, like bothering Ted Cruz as much as I can.
Someone's, you know, got to.
When someone asks me to go to a protest and someone asks me to go to a fundraiser, I'll go, I'll like donate, even if all I can donate is $10, because, you know, I just like want to feel like I'm doing my part. And, you know, I feel like post-election, it's really easy to feel complacent. And there's definitely times when I feel really complacent, but I think if it's just like something that's constantly on your mind and whenever you are asked to take action, like you take action most of those times, I think that can really powerful. If everyone did that, you know, it would be amazing. So yeah, it's complicated, and it makes me like sad that I wasn't more actively involved before, but I'm sort of trying to change that, and it starts with my job and my writing, and I hope that I can help make change through that small way.
Do you get the sense that you have other family members or friends back in Texas who feel similarly, like maybe next time things could be different?
Yeah, I mean, seriously, like my aunt, I call her Singi the Mommy. That's just like what Indians call the familiar relations. But like, she was totally outraged after the election. And, you know, she is a doctor in Texas, and she has certainly been discriminated against. She's been like the person on the plane that like, is there a doctor here? And she's raised her hand, and they've been like, no, we want like a real doctor. And that's awful. And that's just like when you remember the realities of the fact that you live in Texas. And I feel like for a lot of us Indians living in Texas, we existed within this bubble that didn't happen to us a lot. And after the election, my entire family is just like so much more aware. I see us all sort of becoming really politically active, and we're all really close. So it's just exciting to see us all like mobilizing together. Like the day of the Women's March, we were all marching in different places across the country, and we were all texting each other photos, and it was just really empowering. And I feel really fortunate that I'm not one of those families where it's like my parents voted for Trump and we're really, you know, just really distant. We can't go for holidays. I feel at the very least comforted by the fact that my family is like very, very unified in our beliefs.
Yeah. Is it hard for your parents as people who immigrated here?
You know, I thought it would be harder for them, but I think there's this tendency with the older generation to just, I feel like my parents aren't quite as invested as I am. It's a sort of same way when someone appropriates Indian culture, I get really angry about it. But my parents are like, but hey, at least they're acknowledging Indian culture. Like back in our day, like it wasn't even in any part resembling the mainstream. And so I just feel like their perspective is really different. And like, you know, my parents are definitely, sometimes I feel like my parents aren't even like aware of when people discriminate against them, because it's just something they grew up with. They just
like, they're so desensitized to it.
Yeah. In their mind. But I don't want it to be that way for me. I want to be able to call things out. And I feel like my parents and I are having those conversations more than we ever have before.
I mean, that's a nice silver lining-esque thing to come out of all
Definitely.
Of it. Yeah. Well, cool. Tell us more about where we can find your writing. And you have a column for Bon Appetit, yes?
Yes, I have a column called Indianish in Bon Appetit, where I'll be sort of sneak previewing some of the recipes, some of the tips, and some of the offcuts that didn't make it into the book. I have
it's like a nice meat metaphor. Yeah.
So the first column was on how to make chai. It's way easier than you think. And the next one is about how I discovered that the Instant Pot is the best place to make dal, with a little like choose your own adventure chart for how to make your own dal in an Instant Pot. And that probably will come out soon. So I'm excited.
I should have mentioned this. I loved your piece about Urvashi Picha, who's writing an Indian pot book for Houghton Mifflin, in fact, who is also publishing your book, but she's like the Indian pot queen at this point. You wrote a great piece about her in The New Yorker.
Yes, that piece was, when I pitched it, I don't think I realized the extent to which her fans adored her. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I sort of wrote this, I realized she had created like a counterculture of Indian Instant Pot loving cooks.
Yeah, she really tapped into something there.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it, actually when I was reading it and reading more about you, I was wondering if you were reminded at all of your mother when you came across her and were talking to her, because there's something so like entrepreneurial about her and enterprising. And then the way she's been able to use food as a way to kind of like launch, and I guess in her case, sort of like a second career for her.
Yeah. I think, I don't know. They're pretty different. I more relate Urvashi to my aunt, who's the one who introduced me to her, because, you know, sometimes I feel like my mother can be a bit of a masochist when it comes to cooking. Like, she likes when it takes a little more time and requires more finesse and technique, because that's just, you know, it means only she can do it. And, you know, most of the recipes I included in the book are the ones that are like the quick 20-minute weeknight recipes.
Yeah.
But, I feel like my mom is not, she's not a shortcut person. Whenever I try to introduce, like, there are shortcuts and these recipes are easy and accessible, but there are certain things where my mom was like, you just cannot, like, you have to roast your spices before you add them in. You just cannot skip that step, and things like that. Whereas, like, I think Urvashi was able to sort of make use the Instant Pot to make Indian cooking really accessible. I feel like my mom is gonna make Indian cooking accessible, but she's probably not like the gadget cook. That's probably not her niche. But Urvashi is actually from Dallas, and I told her next time I'm in Dallas, me and my aunt who introduced me to her book and her should all get together and like have butter chicken over lunch.
You should you should meet her. Actually, I got to meet her recently, and she is a hoot. So
yeah,
she's a firecracker. Well, tell us where to find you on social media so we can keep up with your writing.
You can follow me on both Twitter and Instagram at PK Gourmet. And then you can catch my byline in the New York Times, Bon Appetit,
No big deal, New Yorker,
New York Times. And a few others. it's pretty cool.
It's real cool.
Yeah, it's definitely really cool. It never, the glimmer of the New York Times never fades.
It never should. And your book is fall 19?
Spring 2019.
Spring 2019. Yep. Okay, well, I am very excited to follow the journey of it and see the final result. Priya, thank you so much for coming on the show. It was really lovely to chat with you, and best of luck with all of your endeavors and your book coming out.
Well, thanks for having me.
You're welcome, and happy Valentine's Day.
You too.
It was a very romantic conversation. Not really. But I did enjoy it a lot. And thank you out there for listening. Check us online at heritageradionetwork.org or as a podcast on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. And we'll see you back here next week, Wednesdays, 6:30 p.m. EST.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.